I'm Michelle Schacht. I'm sharing with you elements from a recent conversation I had with Lance Strait, president of the Institute of General Semantics and founder and past president of the Media Ecology Association, shorter excerpts of which are featured in episode 5 of my audio memoir, Bootleg This, Meet Carol Chen. Recognized for his scholarship, intellectual leadership, and creative activities, Lance is also a professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University, where he previously served as a department chair, associate chair for graduate studies, associate chair for undergraduate studies, and program director for professional studies in new media, a major he developed for Fordham's School of Professional and Continuing Studies. He currently co-chairs the Global Listening Center's Academic Board and has served as president of the New York State Communication Association and the New York Society for General Semantics. And Lance is the author of 8 books, including On the Binding Biases of Time, Amazing Ourselves to Death, and Media Ecology, An Approach to Understanding the Human Condition, and many poetry collections. I asked Lance to speak with me because although I'm engaged and entranced by media ecology and communication, in fact, I have a major in communications as well, I am what Keith Richards would call a bloody amateur. We begin by talking about what transmedia means. We come to this conversation today because you've been so generous and patient in inviting me into an ongoing conversation that you've hosted as the president of the Institute of General Semantics. The main things to cover today are, what is transmedia?
Transmedia is a term that's been used to apply to something that's somewhat new. You know, if you think about movies, sequels, the story is carried through more than one film. The same thing with books as well. That is not transmedia because it's in one medium and continuing over various issues within that one media. But it's somewhat new that media could be used in multimedia way. Those of us that are old enough remember the idea of multimedia going back to the 60s, where it's like, hey man, this is groovy, and you had slideshows going and maybe run a film and have music playing and light shows and that sort of stuff. One example that's been used is the film The Matrix, right? We have the first film and then we have two others as sequels, and that tells one story. But the Wachowski siblings who created The Matrix story also took pieces of the narrative that were not included in the films, were sort of jumped over, and they put one piece into a video game, and it was filmed at the same time as the sequel movies. They filmed segments of it as a computer game and told a part of the story that was not included in the movies. And then they also released on DVD a collection of short anime films that also added to the story and filled in pieces that were not found in the films. So the idea is to get the complete narrative, you have to go across different media. I think another example of this, at least to my knowledge, the Blair Witch Project was maybe the first one where part of the story was found on the internet. You know, when you went to the website and you would get recordings of what went on. The key element is that we're sort of jumping across, and it is something that is particularly characteristic of electronic media, that things are fragmented. When you watch commercial television, what you get is a fragment of the narrative. We've just put them together in our heads as one continuous narrative, but really the story is being told in this very fragmented way. And that kind of discontinuous fragmentation is very much a function of electronic media, where everything is sent to us now and there isn't time to string together a long linear exposition. It goes back before writing. So when we go to oral culture, there's a culture without writing to have episodic narratives. You actually have to be able to put it down on paper and look at the sequence of events and then order it in sort of chronological or psychological order in order to create a purely linear narrative, beginning to middle to end.
Where is a good point to bring up media ecology, the harms and the benefits of the media environment that transmedia storytelling introduced into the ecology?
The harms have been something that we've talked about a lot because it was so hard and it took so long to develop that kind of linear thinking and that kind of logical progression. It doesn't come to us. Naturally, we skip around. Naturally, we're all ADHD. When you're a hunter-gatherer, you want to just be able to scan your environment constantly. So that's what comes natural to us, and to focus and just concentrate and just go step by step by step. That was a hard-won skill, and it came through literacy, especially as it was amplified by printing. So now we get to electronics, and then everything is coming by so fast, we don't have time to stop and put things in order or reflect on things. And a great example, Neil Postman brought this up back in the 80s in Amusing Ourselves to Death about television news, and he referenced the way that they would make transitions from one story to another. That was one story to a completely unrelated story by going, and now this, which is this discontinuous and incoherent format. It's okay for entertainment, and it can have its artistic side to play with this sort of thing and these kind of juxtapositions that we can make. But for coherent thought, we need to quiet things down, reflect, and take things one step at a time. The great advantage in being able to focus and do one step at a time is, you know, how we developed science, technology, all the advances that we were able to get to. Think about democracy too, and you want to be able to focus and analyze and go one step at a time and figure out, is this the right policy? And what's its justification? Is it ethically correct? Is it efficient? Jacques Ellul would argue that when we reduce everything down to efficiency, that's a problem, as long as we don't make that our only criterion, which is what tends to happen under electronic conditions, because you're speeding everything up. Efficiency becomes the only metric that we can go by.
Talking about deliberative skills that had been developed through literacy, reflect, to ponder, to meditate, to balance, to weigh, to measure the information. Has that been damaged? Has it been harmed? Has it been irreversibly destroyed?
Well, yes to most of that. I wouldn't go to the irreversible part because, one, people still read, and depends on individuals. Hope springs eternal that we can reverse this, but the tendency has been to do great harm to those kinds of skills. So even to call it information is harmful, where information comes to us very quickly and disappears very quickly. And in a sense, information is only information before we receive it. Once we get it, it's no longer information. And it's not something you have, it's something. And what information does is resolve uncertainty, but to arrive at a certain opinion is not necessarily to arrive at the right opinion, and it's not necessarily about understanding things correctly. So much of general semantics has been about how do we evaluate what we're taking in, the information, the messages that we're taking in, and can we step back and reflect and properly make sense out of it, because it's too easy not to do that.
Whereas to a topic of predictive technology, you insisted that I understand Norbert Wiener was about feedback loops. Go ahead and just bring everybody up to speed on the point Wiener was making.
A lot of these folks have gotten kind of canceled. Norbert Wiener, Gregory Bates. You go back to the World War II era and its immediate aftermath, and a lot of folks were getting funding from the Department of Defense, including my own field. And they funded communication departments all over the country, partly to fight propaganda, partly to promote the United States. Wiener comes to this idea that feedback loops are this key concept, because up to this point, what people are thinking about is largely one-way communication, messages that are sent. Going back to Aristotle's rhetoric, for example, he's imagining the speaker gives an address to the audience, and the audience reacts, so it's always going one way. And Wiener discovers this idea of feedback, which is the response that comes from the receiver back to the sender, which influences the sender. And his great example is the thermostat. The thermostat is basically a feedback device because without it, you just turn the heater on and heat the room up, but you can't get it to your desired temperature. It just keeps pumping heat out until you turn it off. But with a thermostat, it gets the feedback of what temperature the room's at, and when it reaches the desired temperature, it shuts the heater off. And when the temperature starts to drop, it turns it on again. And Wiener goes, "This is it. This is the answer to everything. This explains life. This explains the way the mind works, explains psychology. I have found the answer," which is a bit much, but people get excited when they come to these things. And this is the essence of ecology. Interdependence is about feedback loops. So it was a step towards systems theory. All of these ideas can be used for good or for evil. But for Wiener, this is the basis also of interactive technology, of this new kind of technology where we don't just send messages out like we do with broadcasting, but we can interact with a machine as well as interact with other people through the machine.
So let me try to take advantage of your galaxy brain here by asking you to weave the thread of Wiener's feedback loops with some of the consequences of transmedia storytelling. Why I'm asking you to try to integrate these two points is because you've been so patient with me in the narrative that you just explained about Wiener, his epiphany about thermostats being the answer to one-way transmissions.
So when we look at technological advances, a lot of it starts with military advances. Even something like the alphabet was a military technology. And when you talk about command and control, and that's really the basis, right? And that's why the first empire, the Egyptian empire, is based on writing. Because in order to coordinate a large armed force, you need a means of communication beyond word of mouth. And that was writing. In order to control territory at a distance, the control has to send information, orders out, but also get feedback back and then adjust their orders, adjust the command structure. So it really follows through. Then we get to this current age and where Wiener is bringing in cybernetics. That was his term for this science of control. When it's applied to technology, cybernetics was a term that was early on applied to computer technology. When you think about it in those terms, you program a computer, you send it instructions and data, and then you get a response back. And often that response is error, 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 and then you change the program and send it to the computer. So it is interactive in that sense. And what it opens up is a new kind of media experience that we call participatory. So you play video games and you're participating. You're not just passively taking in messages. You are participating in whatever it is that's going on, which could include a narrative. Back when we had newspapers, you read the first story and it says continued on page 12. Do you now continue with that story, or do you go on to the next story on the front page? We make these choices. We participate in the construction of transmedia. We have to participate in the sense that we have to go to a different medium to get one part of the story. And if we don't, you can skip over it, but that's a choice that we have to make now in terms of transmedia. So it does open up the world.
So listening to you here, I'm thinking that the word participatory does not at any point sound like a negative.
Right.
It doesn't sound like a harm at all. What is possibly deleterious about participatory media, participatory government, participatory society? The only thing I can think of, as we evolutionarily developed a mosaic perception, mm-hmm. and then we were trained in a linear literary ability, that became the basis for a social contract. What happens when that social contract gets fragmented, shattered, and fractured, does it end up being something that takes us back to a mosaic form of perception, or does it evolve into a different kind of perception?
When you bring up mosaic, that brings to mind Marshall McLuhan and the distinction he makes between hot and cool, where hot is everything's presented to you and you don't have to add anything to make meaning, and cool has these missing parts to it, so you have to fill in what's missing from the message. And in that way, we participate. That's where hot doesn't require our participation, cool media does. And the thing about it, though, is how could television be a cool medium when you're very passive? And McLuhan's point is that involves a lot of processing on our part, which doesn't leave a lot of room for action. That is, in a sense, the harm, is when we become so absorbed by this and so involved that we aren't freed up to take action or do things in the real world. We just get sucked into the medium itself and absorbed by it. That is part of the harm. But of course, part of the harm also that you're bringing up is that we lose a kind of common culture. When everyone participated in this earlier time, we all participated in the culture that we shared. We all sang our culture's songs and told our culture's stories over and over again. So it was a unifying thing. This now is very fragmenting and turning us into these very distinct and separated tribes, so that the story that I tell from these pieces can be totally different from the story that you tell. And the participation is, well, you, Michelle, are a great musician. And let's make no bones about that. And, you know, I'm what Keith Richards call a bloody amateur. But we could both put songs on Spotify and in that sense now have equal status. One of the criticisms against the internet is this becomes the cult of the amateur, in the same way that some scientist who is trained and does research and reads in the journals, and some idiot who just is blathering on comes across as equally valid on Twitter or YouTube. That becomes the problem when these QAnon lunatics say, do your own research. What are they doing? They're participating by looking for pieces and putting the fragments together. And of course, you can put fragments together to form a conspiracy. It's quite easy because we're very good at that. But it doesn't make it true. It doesn't make it accurate. I go back to the general semantics. We say the map is not the territory. We're all making our own maps now. And they're not equally valid. There are good maps and there are bad maps. If the map takes you to where you need to go, great. But if it takes you somewhere else and you get lost.
Thank you for articulating so well the harms that may not be evident on the surface about both participatory culture and also the consequences of fragmented transmedia narratives. I'm hoping that we can wrap this by advancing to how the technology, as it's evolving, and I'll just refer to it as AI, but what I mean by AI, because it means a lot of different things, is almost like a sausage grinder of taking all kinds of data and putting it into an extruder that can be prompted to bring out whatever narrative the prompter is requesting. My experience of it being the subject of a defamation campaign is that it doesn't matter what the facts of the narrative were. It simply matters that it provides grist for the mill.
On AI itself, this is, of course, an old idea. That participatory sense, it was Vannevar Bush in 1945, writes an article for Atlantic Magazine, As We May Think, which is both about AI and about hypertext, before that word was coined. But again, it is that interactive participatory sense. I guess it was the 60s when Joseph Weizenbaum does the ELISA program, modeled after a Rogerian therapist. And it's just this interaction where it's just mirroring back what you put into it. And he was shocked that people got really attached to it. knowing that this is just a stupid little program, and even more horrified that the American Psychological Association was saying, oh, we can imagine a future where this kind of programs, these artificial therapists, you know, you could go to a kiosk somewhere and get therapy from a machine, which I don't know if you ever saw George Lucas's first film, THX-1138, it kind of imagines some of that coming in. So that part of it, it's nothing new, and you go to something more recent like Google, and any kind of expert system or database that has this algorithm to access it, that's artificial intelligence too. So really what we've been doing is improving the processing and improving the interface to it, but it's not all that new. The social media algorithm is what they're presenting to you based on analyzing your own search history and all of that. And that is a form of artificial intelligence. So with the participatory nature, I think back to MySpace before it crashed and burned, and it really started out as a place for musicians without contracts, without a record deal, to put their music, and it had a music player, and then it sort of evolved into a social media that was before Facebook became the thing. MySpace was the social network of choice, but that all these great artists could put their music, make it available and let people know about it, but you still had to know how to make music, right? You still had to have some skill at making music. And of course, there are lots of musicians out there who are really good, but never make it for one reason or another. They don't get the break, or they don't have the originality, or whatever it is. So now AI allows people to participate in a way that really short circuits everything. You go back to the Beatles, and you know they honed their skills over years and years of performance, you know, of live performance, before they ever got to making even their earliest albums or earliest singles, I should say. But now I can just go on there and access an AI program and create through AI, just tell it to, you know, make a song like the Beatles, and we can get there. And okay, well, that's great for me because I get to go, wow, I made this. This is fun. I get to have that pleasure of creation, but without any of the skill, without any of the learning. And at what point, I was in China for over a couple of years, 2 months total. One of the things that was very different there was when you went to parks, they would have large stones or boulders in the park placed as if they were statues. And I remember my host explaining, this is something to look at and contemplate. I thought it was very interesting. And it's like, yes, we can get an aesthetic experience out of non-human and even non-living things. You can look, you enjoy the sunset, for example. And that's an aesthetic experience. And in the same way, we can be entertained and enjoy machine-produced products that didn't involve anything. But that's for ourselves, for all people to be involved in creative expression. And that's what's lost. Even if you are the person who does the prompt, you're not really getting anything out of learning how to play a guitar or learning how to sing on key or learning how to write. We're losing that part, but it's also on the other end. Sure, I could enjoy a song that was created by AI, but that doesn't give me any insight into the human condition. And one of the reasons for us to be interested in creativity is not just, this is a great song, I'm grooving to it, let's dance or whatever, but this is a song by Michelle Schacht, and it tells me something about her as an individual, but also speaks to our common experience as human beings. And I'm not going to get that from AI-produced material.
Lance, that was beautiful and articulate, and leaves me a little embarrassed to say I've introduced you in this conversation as an authority on media ecology, on general semantics. But what you just demonstrated there, and particularly with that example of the rock being a piece of sculpture in a garden, was a very poetic way of, I just want to say this for the record, Lance is my favorite poet, and it's how he won my loyalty in my heart, and I've been hanging out with him ever since we first had that fight about Norbert Wiener. thank you for the very beautiful way that you brought it full circle. And I want to tell you now, kind of in an old tradition of our point-counterpoint approach, that what you experienced of MySpace as originally a platform for music and then later a social media platform for audiences to interact around their favorite music, I had a very different experience of MySpace, which is that someone created a Michelle Schacht MySpace page. Mm-hmm. And my reaction was, hey, I'm Michelle Schacht. I didn't authorize this. I did not give permission to put this up. And their response was, oh, you want it? Here, you can have it. Which on the surface appears to be very generous. Like, we weren't trying to profit. We were just, trying mm-hmm. until you showed up. But what you realize later on is that that was how MySpace got great artists on their platforms, is by basically shanghaiing them, kidnapping them, saying, you must participate or you will be the victim of an imposter. And that's a very different experience than audiences who now in this AI era feel like they get to participate in that creative economy, whereas the artists that had their soul stolen, their life's work stolen, their identity stolen, their integrity stolen, it feels like a very, very different thing. But it took a poet to really say, yeah, you can appreciate a rock or a sunset. That's just as valid an expression. But something else is going on when you steal someone's work.
To put it in a media ecological context, is to remember that back before printing, really, there was no idea of copyright or intellectual property. And mostly because there was nothing at stake. If I had an invention, an idea, whatever I could make locally from it, and the credit I got locally from the people I know was all that existed. And if other people were to use that, fine, that would be okay. In the same sense that it's like all those songs by that Greek guy Anonymous, somebody wrote them. But then after printing, there's something more at stake, which is economic. And it actually was the printers and publishers who argued for copyright and introduced this idea. But at a certain point, and it's important because it is what motivates creation, creativity, and following that, now electronics comes in and it becomes so easy to copy, and it really undermines the idea of copyright, if not completely destroys it, because folks can sue for copyright infringement. Disney, for example, was fierce when going after somebody who's doing like a little mimeographed church newsletter and includes a little image of Donald Duck in there, and they send him a cease and desist order. It becomes so easy to do this now that it really is destructive of those protections that. And you look, why did we have copyright? The founding fathers of our nation really understood that. It is to protect and reward creativity, which is what moves us forward, which was what gives us progress. And to do it for a time, not forever, but for a period of time, to protect that, because that way we encourage the arts, we encourage science, we encourage discovery and creativity. This completely undermines that whole system in a very destructive way. I get some of these AI newsletters, and there's one that says, which one was created by AI? And they give two images, and they're almost completely identical. And so, well, if one of these are created by AI, and it's almost completely identical to the one that wasn't created by AI, in what sense is it created by AI as opposed to just a digital copy? What's the difference then? There is no difference. And that's where we really have to say, comes down to Michelle, what do we want as a society? Do we want to encourage the people who are the most talented? Because it's not distributed equally. So we want to encourage people to do the best that they can and to reach the highest heights that they can? Do we want to encourage scientific discovery? Do we want to encourage the writers to write and to earn a living? And it sure as hell isn't the government that's going to fund this kind of work. So, I mean, we live in this kind of system where people are sort of entrepreneurial in their own kind of creativity and discovery and work. Do we want to encourage that? Or do we want a system that sort of brings everything down to the lowest common denominator? So we're all amateurs putting our stuff out there. And then what are we doing to earn money? Well, the AI is taking all the other jobs. So I guess it's got back to manual labor because that's about all that's left until the robots take over. So, I mean, what's the point of it all?
Well, thank you. And I'm also going to let you have the last word on all that stuff about copyright.
Just because you can do something doesn't mean you ought to do it.
Thank you. There's more from my conversation with Lance we'll be sharing as we complete my audio memoir, Bootleg This. I'd also like to thank Lance Strait again for his contribution to this ongoing conversation. I'm Michelle Schacht. Our featured conversation was recorded at Radio Wave Studios, New York City. Engineers Yuris Ming and Corinna Tariki. Editing by Yuris Ming, mastering by David Shin, produced by Sue Zizza for Sue Media Productions. Production copyright 2026, Michelle Schacht and Sue Media Productions. Okay.